I should mention, brethren, as I'm getting set up here, I'd like to thank everybody who came out to the picnic last weekend and made it possible. It was really fun to be with you all and to have you there. The weather wasn't too bad, and we had Tent City. It was great, so you could get out of the shade, the sun a little bit and get into the shade, which was pleasant. And then not a listed activity, but the opportunity to throw my nephew in the pool was too great, so we had a pool party impromptu. The pool is still recovering, but I'm sure one of these days my nephews will be old enough to pick me up and toss me in something I don't want to be in. So until then, I'm in good company or safe by myself. Well, brethren, today I'd like to look at a book that perhaps we don't focus on too much on, or if at all. You know, in fact, I was going to play the jelly video where he tries to learn the books of the Bible, because, well, I think he illustrates a pretty good point when it comes to the minor prophets in the book of Habakkuk. He says, let me paint a picture. If you haven't watched the video, it's good. I was hoping that sound would come through, but it didn't. Anyhow, imagine a little blue thing that's a stuffed creature, or Jelly himself is in a swing, and he's swinging back and forth, minding his own business, calmly, or maybe not calmly, but feverishly flipping through the scriptures, like someone who can't read. And he's feverishly flipping through it, and you'll notice Mr. Jonathan comes along, and he asks him what he's doing, and after some antics, they come up with a game to play. And they say, all right, Jelly, I'm going to list a book of the Bible, and you find it. And he says, okay, James. And I can't remember if he said James. And then he says Habakkuk, and Jelly says back, what, there's karate in the Bible? And that's kind of the punchline, as he says, well, you need some help. But brethren, when it comes to Habakkuk, I think that's a lot of us when we say there's karate in the Bible, or Habakkuk, who? What's that about? I don't think I've ever read that book. I'm not familiar with that passage. And so today, I actually want to go back, and I want to look at maybe one of the more lesser-known books, one we don't spend a lot of time in. I don't know if many of us spend a lot of time in the minor prophets at all, but I find them fascinating. A little bit maybe more depressing, which, I don't know, not that that's enjoyable, but it's interesting because there's so much packed in so little. It's a short book. It's only 3 pages. In fact, by the time I'm done with the introduction, you probably could have read through it if you're a speedy reader once already. That's not suggesting you should. I'm just saying you could. So, in that, though, it's a powerful book. It's a powerful message. It's a message of hope. It has duality. It has prophecy. It was written in a world that was changing. You look at the geopolitical situation that is occurring during the time of Habakkuk, and it's crazy. It was in turmoil. And we'll talk a little bit about that today as well. So today, I want to cover a little bit about the book of Habakkuk. I'd like to have an introduction. We're going to learn all we can about the prophet, and to do that, we're going to discover and talk about the who, the what, the when, the where, and the how. And then we're going to talk about the woes of Babylon, which is the vision of the book. And as we do this, we're just going to cover some basic things. And as part of this introduction, we'll cover, you know, who, that seems obvious, the what, that's what he was occupationally, and things of that nature. And then we'll look at the when, and we'll go through some of those geopolitical situations that were going on at the time of Habakkuk, the things, the transitions, the collapse of Assyria, and the rise of Babylon. Then we'll go through with the where, and then the how. We'll talk through the themes of the book. We'll look at the structure of the book, and then we'll conclude with the woes of Babylon, or the vision. And so to do that, let's go on to the who. Who was Habakkuk? Well, kind of interestingly enough, I'm trying to think. He just sort of pops up, unknown. I was thinking of maybe like Melchizedek, without father, without mother, but that maybe didn't seem like a good analogy. But father, unknown. Mother, unknown. Okay, so that's. He just kind of shows up as a prophet of God. And then he pops up to be present, and he gives an oracle, and he gives a message. I was doing some research for this sermon and listening to Dr. Ward's sermon from 2009. I think you can find it on the UCG website. Well, I know you can find it there, but the date is something I don't remember off the top of my head. And he says that the actual name of the prophet is very beneficial in understanding the message. And his name means to embrace, or I was looking up a Bible dictionary, and it also says the name of the garden plant. But most authorities or most commentaries think that his name means embrace. And what it would mean to be is literally embraced by God. So he's embraced by God. When you're embraced, you're comforted. So embraced, oh, that was speedy. All right. So, brethren, we will look on to who. Are we covering the who? Unknown. But we're going to go into the what, which is sort of tied to the who. What was he? Turn with me to Habakkuk if you can find it. Brethren, don't be afraid to use your index. It may need to be done. It would for me. Although, I will admit, preteen camp was very helpful for the last six books of the Minor Prophets. Because until then, I always like, Nahum, Haggai, Zephaniah. I'm going to look in the index or just flip randomly till I see the name. But I guess you shouldn't admit that, but it's a lesser known book. So Habakkuk, just before Zephaniah, right after Nahum. So if that's not obscure. He says in 1:1, what is he? Well, he's a prophet. That seems sort of obvious, brethren. He says, the burden, the oracle, the message the prophet had was given, which the prophet Habakkuk saw. So we see right off that what is he? Well, he's a prophet. Then his occupation. Well, what did he do? Well, sometimes Scripture tells us what the folks did before they were a prophet of God. You can think of Amos. Let's turn back to, I'm going to test you in the Minor Prophets here. Turn back with me to Amos. And if you're anything like me, you always have to say Hosea, Joel, Amos. So Hosea, Joel, Amos. Amos tells us explicitly what he did. We knew what David did before he became a prophet and a king of God. He says, so in Amos 7, and in verse 14 of chapter 7, it says, then Amos answered and said to Amaziah, I was no prophet, nor was I the son of the prophet. This is not a hereditary position that I have. But I was a sheep breeder, and I was a tender of sycamore fruit. Then the Lord took me as I followed the flock, and the Lord said to me, go prophesy to my people Israel. So what did Amos do? Well, he was a tender of fruit, and he was a shepherd. So we know explicitly what he did. Habakkuk, on the other side, and on the other hand, is a little more open to interpretation. If you would, you can put a ribbon in Habakkuk, because we'll flip around today, brethren. But in Habakkuk 3, we're going to look at verses 1 and verse 19. We're going to see little indications of what he might have actually done. Maybe. So, in the conclusion, and like I said, when we get into the how, we'll start talking through the theme and the structure of the book. But just as like a little preview, we see here that Habakkuk says, a prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet, a shigonoth. Well, that's a musical term most likely used. And then we'll read in verse 19, it says, the Lord God is my strength. He will make my feet like deer's feet. He will make me walk on my high hills to the chief musician with my stringed instruments. So the indication is, between these two passages, that most people feel that he may have been a Levite, part of the temple service. Somebody that would be in charge of music, would write hymns. In fact, a lot, if not all, of the book of Habakkuk is poetry. So we see here that he's most likely a musician, using musical terms. The term Shigonoth used here in chapter 3, verse 1, is the plural of, well, it's the plural of the term. And it's, I'm going to read here from Nelson's New Illustrated Bible Dictionary. He says, the plural of Shigion, a part of the Hebrew heading for Psalm 7. So it's used also in Psalm 7, probably referring to an erratic, enthusiastic ode or to a psalm of lamentation. Well, when you read the book of Habakkuk, you could see a psalm of lamentation seems appropriate. I think of maybe more of like a minor tune, you know. If you play the guitar or musically inclined, some of those minor chords, I think of that when I think of the book of Habakkuk. So the indication is that he would be a part of that temple service, a Levite, and it's interesting. No one really knows what the word means, but they all speculate kind of that it's some sort of musical term that applies a type of song or singing. I have from gotquestions.org, I like this last part as it describes what this term might mean. It says, David classifies his song as a shigon. Habakkuk says that his song should be sung in the manner of a shigoneth, and as best we can tell, a tumultuous poetry of Habakkuk 3 and Psalm 7 was to be accompanied by music that fit that theme. On shigoneth probably meant with impassioned triumph, with rapidity, or abrupt changes in tune. So it almost sounds like it might be a musical term for something that's discordant. Maybe not so pleasant to the ears. But so we see what Habakkuk was. We think that he was a Levite, and we think that he most likely had something to do with the temple service and the musical aspects thereof. So let's get into the when. All right. My mouse is going to fight against me. Let's get into the when. Just following the biblical example, if something is evil, just put it far from you, cast it away. So when was Habakkuk? I really enjoy this aspect of, like, when you look at the prophets and what was going on, and sometimes you don't get a full picture when you look at something in isolation, when you just say, okay, well, Habakkuk reigned and, you know, or not reigned, but prophesied sometime between 612 to 605 or maybe 600 or 608, and you look at it as an isolated event. Well, that's neat, but what's going on around him? What's going on in the kingdom? What's going on in the world? What do we know related from the Bible, from history, as to something that would indicate some of the things that he was living through? And so part of that is most people feel that he was most likely during the reign of Jehoiakim, 608 to 598 BC. Now let's turn back to 2 Kings 23:31. And we'll start in 2 Kings, and you can also, if you'd like for your notes, 2 Chronicles 36. You know, the kingdom is, well, not doing well. Let's just put it that way. It's on its way out. Remember, how did Jehoiakim come to power? Well, his father was killed by Pharaoh Necho. That's Josiah, the last good king of Israel. And then shortly thereafter, his brother becomes king, lasts all of 3 months before he's carted off down to Egypt. So 2 Kings, and we're going to read in chapter 24, chapter 23. So we've actually summarized verses 26 through 30. We'll pick it up. And we'll say in 31, Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he became king, and he reigned 3 months. This is his brother. In Jerusalem, his mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. Now I'm pretty amazed at that he's got a three month reign, and already it goes from Josiah, who did follow the Lord, to his son, He did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all his fathers had done. Then it says in verse 33, now Pharaoh Necho put him in prison at Riblah in the land of Hamath, that he might not reign in Jerusalem. So he disposed him and put up a vassal. And his vassal was his brother Jehoiakim. And this is when we think that Habakkuk was, this is during his reign that we think Habakkuk was prophesying. It says, keep reading it, Jerusalem, and he made him pay tribute of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. Then Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, son of Josiah, king in place of his father Josiah, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. And Pharaoh took Jehoahaz, and went to Egypt, and he died there. So we see during this time, the kingdom has gone from a relatively high point in Judah's history. Josiah was reigning. Then Josiah is killed by Pharaoh Necho. Then we see his son comes up in his place. So even within the kingdom of Israel, or Judah, I should say, there's a lot of turmoil. There's a shift. You've had basically three leaders in the span of like 3 months before Jehoiakim rules. And you have all these internal wranglings. And then you have geopolitical wranglings as well, which we'll get to in a little bit. But first, I want to talk about who were Habakkuk's contemporaries. Who was witnessing these things with him? Who was prophesying to the people along with him? Well, his contemporaries were as follows. I tried to fix it for the Zephaniah, so I have to apologize that I had somebody help me improve the slides, but that one missed our attention the way this comes out. But he was not alone, brethren. Look at all the contemporaries that he had around him. Jeremiah would have spanned before 609 BC. Now, remember, 609 BC, that's the death of Josiah, and that's his interaction with the king, or Pharaoh Necho. 605, we'll get into that in a little bit. That's the fall of Egypt and the conclusion of the Assyrian Empire at the Battle of Carchemish. But, so you see Jeremiah, he's there. He's through all of this. When you look at that, I hadn't really thought about how long Jeremiah was around, what he was witnessing, what he was seeing, the downfall, the things that he would have witnessed and been a part of. You have Zephaniah. He explicitly, let's go to Zephaniah. We're going to test your minor prophet skills today. Zephaniah, because he'll tell us when he reigns. And it's interesting because his book is a part of the minor prophets as well as looks to the day of the Lord. So he says, "The word of the Lord which came to Zephaniah, the son of Cushai, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hezekiah, in the days of Josiah, the son of Amnon, king of Judah." So he's reigning through Josiah's, or prophesying in that time for Zephaniah. So he's coming up into, and that's why I've stopped it. Most likely, he probably, hopefully, lived on beyond the death of Josiah. But that's his reign. And then if you read, it's interesting because all the books, we'll go to a major prophet, Jeremiah. Because Jeremiah also gives his span of his reign as well, or his prophecy. Sorry, reign. I keep using that word incorrectly. It says in Jeremiah 1:1, "The words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, of the priests who were in Anath in the land of Benjamin, to whom the Lord came in the days of Josiah, the son of Amnon, king of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign." So I have in my inspired margin sometime between 625 and 627 BC. So, side note, I can tell by your faces that you're all rapturously enjoying history. I love it. So 625 to 627 BC, this is when Nabopolassar starts coming up and you have the decline of the Assyrian army. So, just fun fact out there. "In the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah," who's Jehoiakim, right? He's the king that's around when Habakkuk, our prophet of interest, is prophesying. He says, "In the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, until the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah." Well, what's the 11th year of Zedekiah? Well, that's that red circle with a line through it. That's the end of the kingdom. And that's the third captivity. That's the destruction of the temple. So basically, we see here that Jeremiah starts at the beginning and he goes all the way. And whether he's prophesying, you know, it says explicitly the time that he's prophesying, but he's most likely living before those events. And I have the dotted arrows. You can't see the third one of Daniel, but they're sort of dots that they go on, right? They continue on for a little bit. Who knows how much longer Jeremiah lived after the collapse of the empire or kingdom or any of those folks. So it says, "In that, it came also in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, until the 11th year of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, until the carrying away of Jerusalem captive in the fifth month. It's pretty explicit as to when that ends for him. Ezekiel. It's like a fun puzzle. You get to put it all together and start overlaying the dates. And it's like, last week, Mr. Kinsella talked about those, I want to say transparencies, but they're the sheets you can put of the human body, one over top of each other. You know, the acetate sheets, I think is the name he used. But, you know, you could start overlaying them and get a fuller picture of the human body. Well, same thing here. You start overlaying the dates. You start overlaying the prophecies. You start overlaying who was doing what, when it was happening. You start getting a fuller picture of the message brought to us by the prophets. So Ezekiel 1:1. Now it came to pass in the 13th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, I was among the captives by the river Chebar, that the heavens were open, and I saw visions of God on the fifth day of the month, which was in the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity. So this is around 592 BC that he starts having his prophetic proclamation as well. And then if you'll notice, Daniel, I went back and doing my research and in looking at this, noticed that Daniel was either a part of the first or the second wave of captivity. So you'll notice that Nebuchadnezzar came in the first time. He took some stuff. He came in again, took some more stuff. And then finally he comes in again and takes it all. And Daniel either was in the first wave or the second wave. So that's either 597 or 605 BC that Daniel would have started and would have gone into Babylon. So what I find fascinating and maybe somewhat comforting about this slide as you look at it all and you think about what the prophets were doing and their role within the structure and framework of the nation, they weren't silent. They were telling, they were warning, they were telling Judah what's coming, what's happening. He had a message. He was sending it to his people and he was proclaiming to them so that they knew what was coming, that they knew their sins, they knew all of this. I find that very comforting and reassuring that God sent all these people in this framework to tell them and to preach that message, and that he did not leave them without warning. Well, brethren, just as we notice who is around at this time frame, and it seems like, as we've talked through it, it seems like the nation of Judah was a little bit in turmoil. The world was too. Right? Just like, well, maybe that analogy doesn't fit. But, so it's a world in transition. Remember those dates, 625, 627 BC? You have the start of what they call, it was the Neo-Media army. You have Nabopolassar, the father of Nebuchadnezzar. You have him coming in. You have the fall of Nineveh in 612 BC. So that seems like a transition of world powers. You have the Egyptian army, you have the Assyrian Empire, you have the Battle of Carchemish, kind of like the final cleanup of the Assyrian army. Now remember, that 606, 605 time frame, that's the first wave of captives, right? Then you go to 597, the next dotted line, you have the second wave of captives. And then sometime between 609 and 600, you have our key Habakkuk prophesying. But look at this, brethren. The world is shifting. How long had Assyria been in power? Hundreds of years. You know? How long had Egypt been a major force? The world was in flux, and you see the rise of Babylon. You see it, and then what's interesting about it, too, is when you look at Habakkuk's message and you think about the world shifting around him and all these different things going on, and then we'll get into this in a little bit, that it's also an end-time message, and you think about our world and our world in flux and all the things shifting and going around it that we see. Because the world is, world was pretty constant up until this time frame, until the collapse of the Assyrian and the Assyrian Empire and the subjugation of Egypt. And then you have the rise of Babylon. Also note that 605, you remember back to Mr. Hansen's sermon on Daniel? Not a single hand. Nobody remembers? Anyhow, Mr. Hansen gave a sermon on, putting you all on the spot. Mr. Hansen gave a sermon, and he talks about Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar's father, dying, and then you have Nebuchadnezzar going back to Babylon to become installed as full king of Babylon. Well, that's sometime in that 605 time frame as well. So then we have the rise of Babylon. Remember that head of gold spoken in the book of Daniel. So the world is shifting. Remember that as we read through the book of Habakkuk and we look at the message and the woes and the vision that was given to Habakkuk, the oracle, we see this, that the world was changing. Well, where was it all taking place? Well, it's unknown. So this slide could be titled Carl's Speculation. So I like to just put that disclaimer out there, but it's not a footnote for notes. Judah, city unknown, possibly Jerusalem. That's my speculation, right? Because let's go back to Habakkuk. And in Habakkuk 2, verse 20, it says, "But the Lord is in his temple, in his holy temple." So that's Habakkuk 2, verse 20. Sorry, I beat you all. I kept my ribbon where it needed to be. 2:20, "But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let the earth keep silence before him." So we see that the temple is still standing. So you'll see that there's still some structure to the city. And then also, as well, you can pair with it, in my mind, Habakkuk 3:19. Why would he be giving, something to the chief musician if he wasn't a part of that scene or a part of that city? So that's, like I said, this is Carl's speculation as to where, but in my mind, it makes sense. Now let's move on, brethren, to the how. The how of the book, right? We've talked about the who, what, when, where. Let's go to the how. Chapter 1. So in my mind, brethren, the book of Habakkuk is broken up into three parts. I like to think of it as maybe this way. You have an introduction or a prologue. You have the body, and then, or the story, the main point, the vision of Habakkuk, and then you have the conclusion or the epilogue. I don't know. That's just how it comes into, is the way I read it and the way I see it. So we see here the prologue being a debate, maybe a question-answer session with God and Habakkuk. We'll read a few passages, and he says, God, how long are you going to let this go on? Right? In verses 1 through 4, he says, we see the burden of which the prophet Habakkuk saw. So he says, "O Lord," in verse 2, "how long shall I cry, and you will not hear? Even cry out to you violence, and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity, causing me to see trouble, for plundering and violence are before me? There is strife and contention arises. Therefore, the law is powerless and justice never goes forth, for the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, perverse judgment proceeds." So he starts it out as an introduction in his first few verses. Starts building the story. God answers back in the next passages and says, "Hey, I see what's going on. I'm raising up the Chaldeans. This is what's going to happen. I'm going to use them to punish Israel." Next, Habakkuk says, "Really? Can you use a wicked people to punish us? Is that what you're going to do?" And that debate or that dialogue goes on through the next few verses of chapter 1. And then chapter 2, you sort of have Habakkuk's sort of conclusion to his questioning. And he says, and he summarizes it in Habakkuk 2:1, "I will stand my watch, and I will set myself on the rampart and watch to see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected." I've read different commentaries who say he was ready to go back to work and be established and be ready to do what God said. And the way I read this is sort of fatalistic. I've questioned, I've discussed with God, I'm going to go see and wait and see what he says. So that sort of concludes the first sort of introduction or the prologue to the book. And then the remaining part of chapter 2 is the vision which he says he saw. Because in chapter 2, verse 1, or chapter 2, verse 2, it says, "Then the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain on tablets that he may run who reads it." And I find that interesting, brethren, because if you read the commentaries and in looking into it, it's don't conceal the vision, don't make it hidden, but write it. I think it was Feinberg, I was reading that commentary, and he talks about make it big, broad, something that's like a billboard. Paint it out there so that you could see it. He says, write the vision on tablets that he may run who reads it. So we have in chapter 2, we have the main body, the vision that Habakkuk saw. And we'll conclude with this chapter 2 section and the portion of that. But then in chapter 3, we sort of see the summary or the conclusion of the matter. And that's where Habakkuk prays to God. He prays for mercy in verses 1 through 2. And then he praises the remembrance for mercy was out of Nelson's Bible dictionary, but I'm not sure I agree with that, but maybe that's semantics or, I don't know, parsing words. I think if you read verses 13 through 15, it's more of a praise of God's salvation and all the things that God would do. And then it concludes. Yeah, concludes. That makes me think of Tigger and Winnie the Pooh, but I can't. What's a doodles or something? I can't remember what they were. Woozles, that's it. Thank you. Conclusals and woozles. And then we have the conclusion of the praise. And I find really verses 13, 16 through 19 interesting. He says, "When I heard, my body trembled, my lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered my bones, and I remembered in myself that I might rest in the day of trouble. When he comes to his people, he will invade them with his troops." Speaking of something that would happen in the distance. And then he says, verse 17, "Though the fig tree may not blossom, nor the fruit tree be on the vines, nor fruit be on the vines, though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food." So there's nothing to eat, right? You've got nothing on the fig. You've got nothing in the vines. You've got nothing in the fields. The flock may be cut off, so you've got no clothes from the fold. There may be no herd in the stalls. You've got nothing to travel with. "Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord is my strength. He will make my feet like deer's feet, and he will make me walk on my high hills." Think about that praise, that there's nothing, and yet I will rejoice in the Lord. And that's the conclusion of his praise, brethren. And that sort of concludes chapter 3, and it concludes the short book. So next, brethren, let's look at the major topical themes of the book of Habakkuk. I'm looking for the AC dial, but I don't see it in here. It's a little warmer in here, so if you would like, don't feel bashful. You can take your jacket off. So here we have the major themes, and we're not going to discuss all of these, brethren, but I just kind of want to go over them a little bit. So, and give you some homework to go back and read the book of Habakkuk in your spare time and look at it and think about these themes and think about how God answers them. But one of the questions that he has is, why does evil thrive? Why does evil seem to succeed and the righteous seem to suffer? We also have, and I've also sort of in my notes, in my mind, that's part of the introduction, that's part of the prologue. And then the next chapter, or the next bit, is part of the vision that he saw. And that's the day of the Lord and tribulation, future events, right? Because we'll get into this, but in chapter 2, verse 3, he talks about the vision being for an appointed time. An appointed time, a specific time. So we see that as being part of the body or the vision. And then we see in chapter 3, at the conclusion of the book of Habakkuk, some of the themes that he relays there. And that take comfort in God. God is in charge. You know, even through this, you read verses 16 through 19. Even the world is in turmoil and is ending. God is in charge. And he says, God is my salvation. I will rely on him. I think reliance on God is a big part of this. And coming to that point is a big part of the book of Habakkuk. And also, as you look at the themes, and you may come up with different themes or word them a little differently, and that's fine. But you think about that, and you go back to the slides that we discussed previously, the geopolitical slides, the things that were going on in his world, the things that he saw. He saw the collapse, the death of the last good king of Israel. He saw his son come in, be deposed, and he saw his other son come and ruin it, right? Ruin the country. He sees the nation worshiping false gods, idolatry, all the sort of paganism that came flooding back in. It's somehow you see it as like Josiah is a man with both his fingers in the holes trying to stop the leak. And as soon as he dies, his hands come out and the water just comes back in. Another theme is that you might think about is one of the more famous scriptures in Habakkuk, that the just shall live by faith. Habakkuk 2:4, right? He says, the just shall live by his faith. So, brethren, as we conclude this sermon, let's look at the vision that was given to Habakkuk. We've talked about the who, the what, the where, the how. I realize I just skipped the why, but why is not important. Anyhow, so let's go on with the how and conclude with the vision. And the vision that is given to Habakkuk starts with some sort of introductory notes, and that's in verses 3 through 5. And then it breaks itself out into five woes. Five woes. And I've sort of, in my mind, we're laying the sheets upon each other again, brethren, right? We're laying all the sheets so we can get a fuller picture. And in this picture, you have what was done, right? Woe to you because you've done this, right? And this is what's going to happen to you. Woe to you because you were covetous. Your works are going to testify against you. They're going to judge you. They're going to show what you did. Violence and oppression. God's word. There will come a time when God's word will cover the earth. Drunkenness. You know, we'll read in this a little bit. You want to do this? You want to establish this? And you're going to drink from the Lord's cup. And that doesn't sound that pleasant when you read it. And a theme that's throughout. You remember, all right. I'm going to test you again. Mr. Greider was here not too long ago. He spoke on who? All right, Mr. Greider was here a few weeks ago, and he spoke on, he used this in his introduction, he talked about Naaman, right? And in Naaman came to Elisha, and he wanted to be healed of his leprosy, all right? You guys would be terrible in a game show, by the way. So he wants to be healed of his leprosy. And so by doing that, he comes and, you know, Mr. Greider walked through all these procedures of what had happened, and there was nothing that miraculous about it. He said, go dunk yourself seven times in the Jordan, come back and be healed. And he relays this story that he comes back and he wants earth with him. He wants to take mule loads of earth with him back so he can take the local god back home with him. Well, all throughout that is this philosophy of idolatry. All throughout the Old Testament, idolatry and local gods. And Mr. Greider talked about that a little bit. And Israel never got the picture that their God was not a local God, or they never got the picture that their God could not be crammed into a little idol. right? Something made of wood or stone, clothed with silver. No, they never got that. And so, depending on what you read or what commentary you look at, in verse 20 it says, look, speaking at the conclusion of idolatry, but the Lord is in his temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. And I've read some that said that's basically like, shut up, I'm here, I'm in charge. You know? So God, that's why I put, will respect God. You have idols, you do all this, God is in charge, and you will respect him. Remember the scripture that says, every knee will bow. All right, brethren. So let's go through the vision. We'll go through it a little bit, maybe more rapidly. Hopefully time is flying as fast for you as it is for me. Yeah. All right, let's start in verse 3, because I find this is interesting. So he says in verse 2, the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain on tablets, that he may run who reads it. The vision is yet for an appointed time. But at the end, it will speak, and it will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. It is this vision that Habakkuk saw is for an appointed time. It is for an appointed time. The same language or the same word or derivation thereof is used in Leviticus 23. What else is an appointed time? God's feasts. So this is for a specific time. And with a duality of prophecy, you can see it taking place for the Chaldeans and for the destruction of Babylon. And then you look at it, too, as end time events, as in the day of the Lord. All right, verse 4, behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. Right, so we have a contrast of the proud living by their own self-interest, reliance on themselves, and the righteous living by faith, faith in God. Now let's get into the five woes, the punishment on the wicked. So here in the beginning of verse 5, we see the character of the man, which symbolizes the nation. We see this character of what kind of person it is. It says, indeed, because he transgresses by wine. So if you read Feinberg, he said that the Babylonians were given to wine, that they given to much wine, so almost to a state of drunkenness. He says, he's a proud man, arrogance. Remember, contrast that with verse 4, right? Behold the proud. He says, he does not stay at home because he enlarges his desire as hell. And he is like death and cannot be satisfied. And he cannot cannot be satisfied. He gathers himself to himself all nations and helps and heaps up for himself all people. Imagine like a greedy little monster that can get nothing more. Just takes it all. I don't know why, but I envision a small little box with teeth that just sort of clumps around and just chews all that it can and takes everything that it'll get. And it speaks of this in regard, and you think about this, the Chaldeans, and how they just went and scooped up the world, the people, just consumed them. He says he enlarges his, and there's nothing that can be satisfied. And he uses the same sort of terminology. That's in Proverbs 30:16. It says, death cannot be satisfied. Something, as long as there's physicality, death is not satisfied. In that sense. Right? It says, so death is never satisfied. So is the nation or the person not satisfied. And that's a lament that they are like that. So let's start with the verse. First woe. And we'll go through these real quick. So the first woe is plunder, right? He says, woe to him who increases what is not his. Maybe plundering is just a polite word for stealing, right? It's not his, but he takes it. Woe to him who increases. How long? And to him who loads himself up with pledges. You can reference, if you'd like, Deuteronomy 23:19, where God says, hey, you know, you're not supposed to be a creditor. You're not supposed to charge your brethren usury. He says, woe to all these people because you do these things. The same is going to happen to you, right? In verse 8, because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the people shall plunder you because of the men's blood and violence of the land and the city and of all who dwell in it. An interesting study, brethren, as you're doing your homework and reading the three short chapters of Habakkuk, I encourage you to read the three longer chapters of Revelation 17, 18, and 19. And in these, you'll see a parallel of the end time Babylon. And in it, I'd really test you and ask you if you guys remember Bob Fay's sermon when he talked about abominations, but I can tell by your looks that. But we can parallel the account in Revelation 18. He says, right? We have this render the same thing that's going to happen for the same thing that you will do. He says, render to her, speaking of Babylon, just as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her works in the cup which she has mixed. Mix double for her. You know, I can't imagine that it's a pleasant thing to be somebody that God's wrath is against. When we talk about and we look at the sermonette and you looked at that 250,000 miles an hour, which is probably limiting God, and then you looked at like the scale. Remember, that was up at the top corner of the slide. And then we looked down here and I couldn't tell from where I was sitting, but I don't know if the blue line of Mr. Phelps or Mr. Lippincott showed up. So we don't even show up on that. So imagine God's wrath and us in some ways why would we want the wrath of God on us like an infinitely superior being? And that's not to make us afraid. It's just to impart the importance of when we say these punishments will come around and these things will happen, that it's huge. So, coveting. Coveting was the next one. Things that are not yours. You know, that you may fluff your nest. It's like building establishment. It says that he may set his nest on high, build yourself up, that he may be delivered from power and disaster, relying on yourself as well. And then we have in verse 11, those works are going to testify against him. It says, for the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the timbers will answer it, for your shameful counsel of your house. I'm sorry, I read that in misorder, but think about that. And then we tie into this idea of covetousness being linked with idolatry in Colossians 3:5. That is just another form of covetousness or idolatry and the problem that is for people. Then, in the third woe, we move on to violence and oppression of people. Go back to Revelation 18 and 19. How are people treated in the Babylonian system? I think the answer that we should all have running through our mind is not well. Not well, like fodder. If you're not one on the top, it's probably not a pleasant time. Violence and oppression, and that woe. And God answers it with, at the conclusion is, you know, you look at it, man's efforts are futile, and he says in verse 14, speaking of a future time, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord, knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. A future prophecy. A future event. There will be a time when man will know what to do, when God's knowledge will replace the false knowledge and will replace the fruitless efforts of man. The last woe, brethren, is the next one is woe 4. And woefully, it's fourth. But in verse 15, it says, woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pressing him to your bottle, even to make him drunk, that you may look on his nakedness. You are filled with shame instead of glory. You also drink and be exposed as uncircumcised. The cup of the Lord's right hand will be turned against you, and utter shame will be on your glory. For the violence done to Lebanon will cover you, and the plunder of beasts which made them afraid because of men's blood, and the violence of the land, and the cry of all who dwell in it. In verse 15 and 16, most people think that, and most commentaries think that this is symbolic. Drunkenness, and now I will test you. Go back to Mr. Fay's sermon. Remember, we were still meeting in the community center. It was in the days of Unleavened Bread. Any lights going on? Not a one. Man, you guys are killing me. Oh, I got a one. But that's like nepotism. That's my son. It's not fair. So, we have that time. He talked about an abomination. And what do the nations of the world do with the Babylonian system? They become drunk on the wine of her fornication. That same sort of visual terminology, that same sort of language is used in this. Whoa. Let's go back to Revelation. Revelation 17. Because here, remember, what is God going to do here? He's going to give them a cup to drink out of. He says in verse 17, verse 4, the woman was also arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication, and on her forehead was named Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. And I saw a woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of their martyrs, and I saw her, and I marveled in great amazement. Now, parallel, so we look at here and we think about Babylon and the cup that she has and then the cup that she's giving people, right? Because in 18 it says, and 18 verse 3, sorry, I had lost my place. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of her wrath, her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication. So they have, right? Let's go back. Pressing your bottle, even to make him drunk, right? So the leaders of the nation have made themselves drunk with the wine of the cup of the nation of this future Babylon. And God says, I will pour out my wrath. You did this, have a double portion. Drink up. You will get it. To me, it's just amazing. And there's a lot more that can be said here and dug into as we look at the woes and the message and the vision that Habakkuk was given. But the last woe is this woe of idolatry. He says in verse 18, but what profit is the image that the maker should carve it? What does it value you? You've spent effort, you've spent time, but it doesn't heal you. It doesn't make you better. It doesn't do anything for you. He says, the molded image, a teacher of lies, a teacher of lies. Think about that, idolatry and the false system. And then you think about back to who Satan is, right? He is a father of lies. And what's so interesting to me is the parallels of the same themes and these same woes as you look throughout the scripture. He says, a teacher of lies, that the maker of its mold should trust in it, right? That it should be something that you put your hope in, that you trust in. To make mute idols. The idols doesn't speak. Go back and read Jeremiah, right? Woe to him who says to wood, awake! To silent stones, arise! It shall teach! Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, yet there is no breath in it at all. Brethren, we serve a living God, not a dumb idol, not something that's mute, that can't talk, that can't heal. No, we serve a living, powerful God. And he says, woe to them who believe in the idols, that something good will come of it. He says, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. Brethren, it's amazing when we think about that and how much of a problem idolatry was for the people of Israel. That they never got the picture that they served a living God, right? I am the God of Isaac, Abraham, and Jacob, he told Moses in Exodus chapter 3. Brethren, as we conclude today, we've just taken a brief overview of the book of Habakkuk. We've looked at it we've just jet skied over the top of it. We didn't sink in, we didn't deep down, we didn't go swimming. It's an action-packed book. And in fact, we do see there's karate in the Bible. We see that, you know, there's lots of violence taking place, and God will punish that. Well, we see that God will punish the wicked. And we see that the vision Habakkuk was given, we see God's plan in it all, and how he will punish them, and how he will execute his will and fully bring it to pass at an appointed time. Remember, brethren, this vision will come to pass, and we must be ready. We must be ready. Because, as a part of your homework, you'll read the scripture, and it says, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her signs, and lest you receive of her plagues.'" That's Revelation 18:4. We must come out of her, brethren. Come out of Babylon, lest we share in those woes. And we must ensure that we do not fit the characteristics of the woes, that our actions are not like those actions. And as the prophet says, brethren, in times of turmoil, in times of scarcity, we can rely on him. Though everything may fail, no matter what, we should look to God, living by faith, looking forward to the day when the knowledge of the Lord will cover the face of the earth. Have a wonderful Sabbath.